Hi, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm your host, Ray Graff. We discuss wildlife today. We welcome back Ward Stone, the former wildlife pathologist for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Ward Stone is an expert on the fauna you see in your backyard and throughout the region. The number to call here, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also comment on our webpage, wamc.org/voxpop. Check in on Facebook, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Tweet us at WAMC Radio with the hashtag VoxPop or email us, voxpop@WAMC.org. The number to call, however, is 1-800-348-2551. Ward Stone, welcome back to the show. Good to see you.
Pleasure to be here with you and your listeners.
It's
old home week.
It's nice and warm in here, but as you said to me right before we started, it's been a rough winter for the animals.
I think for the early part of my career, it was really bad. And we're talking 69, 68 back in that time.
Yeah. It's okay.
70.
Yep.
But now we've got a old-time winter.
Yep.
And I think we can expect some mortality with wildlife that we hadn't seen much of the last 15, 20 years.
So this would be part of the natural selection process, right? So the weak ones will... not be with us this spring, but the strong ones will be stronger next time.
Well, right? Fawns and older and weak ones will be weeded out.
Yeah.
But if that happened in a series of winters, it could really knock populations down.
And did that happen in the late 60s, early 70s?
It did. It used to be a major thing to talk about what was going to happen to the deer population based upon the winters. And then that kind of... stop being the case.
But we've had a lot of deer for a long time. Is it an overpopulation situation right now? Could this be a good thing?
Who you're talking to.
Okay.
If you're talking to some orchardist who's got damage, say there's too many, or they're selling insurance for automobiles and they've got a lot of car accidents,
yeah,
they're going to say they've got too much. On the other hand, if you're a hunter and expect to get a nice deer every year or so, you may not think that there's too many deer.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Janet in Hurley, you're on with Ward Stone.
Hello, Ward.
Hi.
Hi. I realize that the animals are having a really tough year like we were, too. So I've been feeding the birds, and... I've been feeding them sunflower seeds and a little corn and a few other things.
I think that's a good thing.
It's a very good thing. And I had one or two rabbits last year. And the other night, I noticed there were 10 rabbits out eating the bird feed. And I followed their tracks. They're living underneath my house.
Oh.
So, and I understand why. I know it's cold out, but... spring's coming, and if there are 10 rabbits under there now, I don't think there's going to be fewer animals in my spot. There's going to be more. And I was wondering if you could suggest a way to have them move out.
Okay.
I think they're going to move out pretty much on their own. And because breeding season will come along very suddenly. So they'll be
right. They'll
be mating and moving out and getting ready to have litters. And that happens very quickly in the springtime.
They won't have the litters under the house?
So they won't have them so much under the house, no.
Okay.
They will spread out. They'll spread out across the countryside a little bit. You know, the female comes along and digs a little hole in the lawn or in a field or someplace. And she lines that with hair from her belly. And she has her young in there, and she only goes there a couple times a day.
Mm.
But they are spread around a little bit, both from the point of view of the predators that are going to go after those young.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think they're going to spread out. It's not an easy winter on the cottontail rabbit.
No, it's not. But my rabbits don't come out in the daytime. They come out at nighttime. They come out when it gets dusk. I never see them in the day. So, I hope that they'll move out, and then I'll patch. I'm going to put lattice and stuff around the house so they can't. They're digging in right. I'm in a double wide. They're digging in right underneath the skirt of the house and living underneath the house. So.
Okay. Yeah, I have the same problem. They're living under my shed. A whole bunch of them.
Uh-huh. So they go away in the summer.
I don't know. I don't care.
I think they will spread out from there in the next few weeks because they're going to have a lot of babies in a short period of time. And they're not going to have them all around under your house. They're going to spread out.
I hope not because it will. I'm sure that it won't smell very good.
Janet, thank you for the call.
I think they will definitely spread out. Let me know about what happens.
Okay. Thanks, Janet. Let's go over to Grace in Sheffield, Mass. Grace, you're on.
Hi. Hi, Ward.
Hi.
I'm honored to talk with you. On February 10th, I was sitting in my dining room, and I heard chirpity, 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 chirp. And it was just so loud and clear, I thought it was like somebody's cell phone or something. And so I went to the door and looked, and sitting on the bottom rail of our handrail was a little, what turned out to be a little Carolina wren. And very distinctive and cute.
They are wonderful.
A little tail. I'd never seen or heard one before. And my question is, like, is she going to be okay? I watched her for a while, and then she flew off, and then I got the bird book, and this isn't really their territory exactly.
Hmm.
Sort of the edge of it, but I was wondering if she blew from Boston or...
Certainly with the feeders, they've adapted to the winters a little easier. They were, you know, it's a winter wren. There always were some around. But there were quite a few of them, and I've got some visitors to my bird feeders that are winter wrens, and I'm enjoying them very much.
So they'll be okay.
They're going to be okay.
All right.
They especially like the suet.
Yeah, because it said spiders.
They really go for the suet.
It's going to be hard to find, yeah.
All right. Grace, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Jerry, or is it Terry, in Averill Park? I can't tell.
It's Jerry.
Hi, Jerry. You're on.
Has to do with my bird feeders. I have them out year-round. And in the summer, I get all kinds of birds. Great flocks. Black sunflower seeds, primarily. But now, here, the ground's covered with snow. There seems to be no place where the birds can feed themselves normally. And the activity at the birds' feeders is down tremendously. And I'm wondering what's going on.
I don't know, because the activity, even my bird feeder is not down. It's they are having trouble with snow coming over and covering up food that's spilled. And some of them may have gone a bit south to less inclement areas of habitat, and so you don't see as many birds there. But I'm seeing more birds than usual, more dependent upon the feeding.
I'm seeing really considerably less. And I get, you know, nuthatches, chickadees, goldfinches, titmice. And in the summer, there are hordes of them. I can hardly keep up keeping the bird feeders full. I didn't think of these birds as being migratory.
How are the chickadees? Well, migratory in the sense of, I'm not saying that they're flying to South America, but they can move a few miles to a few hundred miles and still be, you know, far north.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I think they can certainly do that.
So you think probably they've just moved to a more gentle climate?
I think that, yeah, there's a tough winter. I think they picked a spot where it's a little more gentle on them.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you.
Yep. Certainly some nice birds there that you're seeing.
Thanks, Jerry. We appreciate the call. Ward Stone is our guest. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Diane in New Salem. Diane, you're on.
Ray, you're the best thing on NPR.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you very much.
This is a crazy question for Ward. I was bringing in a load of firewood. There was a frozen spider, a good-sized spider, on one of the logs. I put the log in, and he started to crawl around.
Thawed him out.
I did thaw him out, but do they hibernate?
Well, they're not, with their small size, they're not in shape to really maintain an elevated body temperature when
so
we have a winter
been...
like we do. So they go down to really cold temp, and they, of course, head in that direction because they haven't got any way of keeping their temp up.
But can you, so apparently you can thaw them out and they're fine? That's the
They'll
that's
come
the
back and they'll
well,
do pretty well.
He wasn't fine when he was roasting.
Oh, ouch. So he moved pretty fast
for
a moment or two.
He moved pretty fast. As soon as the heat hit, he started crawling around.
Ouch. Well, sorry about the dead spider.
I am too, but I didn't realize that they, you know, were actually dormant and still alive in some sense.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before.
And they're awfully common. There can be thousands per acre.
Well, I still feel your pain, Diane.
Well, I am feeling
not as much as
the
poor spider felt it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You didn't mean it, so it's okay.
Right.
All right.
Thanks, Diane.
I'll scrutinize my wood better the next time.
There
you
go. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You know, speaking of that, Ward, I remember a story. A guy in Del Mar or somewhere in the suburbs had a pet snake, an exotic snake, and it escaped. And I think this was in the news. And he had somehow gotten into, I think, a trash can. It was winter, and it was frozen. And they thawed this snake out with, a hair dryer, and the snake was fine. Have you ever heard anything like that?
No, I would bet that the snake would have a lot of really damage to it if it had any time being frozen.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so... But
would not have made a quick comeback like we're talking about.
All right. 1-800-348-2551. Ward Stone is our guest. Here's one, Ward, from email before we take a break. This is from Mark. I live in a house that has always had an infestation of bats in the attic crawl space. We've never been able to get rid of them, and now we've come to accept them as tenants. I've been hearing about a disease that is killing off a lot of bats. I'd like to know if there is a danger to humans from this disease, and do you have any recommendations for getting rid of bats? We have about 30 seconds before a break, Ward, so go ahead.
I'm glad the bats are doing well. They've suffered from a fungal disease, which is not really a threat to human health.
It's the white nose syndrome?
So, the white nose syndrome. So.
You all right, Ward?
Yep, so I think they're going to be okay, and I think that's a good sign that the bats are not going down to any fungal disease.
And how do you get rid of them?
House. It may be that they're big brown bats, and they have very low rate of infestation with that fungus.
Yeah, okay.
How do you get rid of them?
Yeah.
Well, outside of the rabies.
Give them rabies is what you're suggesting?
Outside of the rabies,
oh,
which comes in.
But you can't get, all right, we'll hash this out.
They're there.
We'll hash this out during a break. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Ward Stone is our guest. We'll be back.
Support comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Edward Garbasik, certified financial planner serving all of Western Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. Ed@HavikinWealthStrategies.com. And Windy Hollow Veterinary Clinic, Montague, Massachusetts, conventional and integrative veterinary medicine, including acupuncture and chiropractic therapy, comprehensive pet care and health services since 1998. WindyHollowVet.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551, the number. Ward Stone is our guest. Boy, the lines are loaded. Ward, everybody's ready for spring after this winter. It has been something. All right, let's go over to Maria
Maria in Ulster County, you're on.
Hi, thank you. It's a question about squirrels, actually kind of a couple of questions. I designed a rustic house for us in the middle of the woods, and it has cedar posts and beams on a covered porch and a cedar railing with the bark on it. And we moved in about 7 years ago, and there was a resident black squirrel, not in the house at the moment, but in the trees near the house. And we did see it with its young once in a while, but we only once in a while would see more than the one squirrel. As time went on, the black squirrel left or died or whatever, and a gray squirrel came. And both the black squirrel and the gray squirrel used to like to scrape the cedar bark off of the posts and beams and carry it away. And I looked that up, and I guess they either eat it or they use it in their nest. So in an attempt to thwart them, we sprayed it with one of those pepper. Cassian pepper sprays that's supposed to be not toxic, but you know, burns or doesn't taste very good. So that helped a little, but they still have been scraping the bark off. And, you know, the house is rustic, so it's not the end of the world, and the bark does come off anyway. But anyway, that aside, this year, and we've had bats making a home on the porch and robins and other birds making nests and stuff on the porch, which I like. But this year, the new gray squirrel has made a nest, took a robin's nest, and made a much bigger nest on my porch under the ceiling. And I saw it in there once, but it's very hard to see. And a couple of times I had somebody go up there with a mirror to see if there was anyone in it. So my question to you is, a couple of questions. One about the bark, but more importantly, I want to take that nest down because I don't want the squirrel on there. I mean, I don't care about the birds and the bats. I like them, but the squirrel will probably chase away the birds.
Okay.
At least.
So how to get rid of the squirrel?
Well, the question is, of course, I can get somebody or climb up myself and take the nest down, but I'm afraid there might be babies in it.
Not right now. Too cold for them.
When should I take it down?
Well, this is a good time right now because it is so cold. They will not be nesting.
Okay. I'm sorry. So they don't have babies when it's this cold?
Right.
Okay. That's great. And what about the bark?
But the only thing I know for sure that nests in this kind of weather is the common pigeon.
Really?
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Say that again. I couldn't hear you.
Common pigeon.
Common pigeon is the only thing he knows that nests in this kind of weather.
Columba
Livia. No, it's not a pigeon. I've seen.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying that. But with the temperatures that we have, the only thing that would be attempting nesting.
I see.
Mammal
understand.
Or bird. Well,
we're
running into the period where the owls are coming into nest.
Right. Do you have any thoughts about how to deter the squirrel from the bark?
Beside pepper spray, which apparently didn't work.
Well, it kind of works. You have to keep it up a lot, and it's really it takes hours to do, and it's really a pain in the neck, and it's expensive. So,
any ideas, okay. Ward?
No, that's a good idea.
Okay.
You know what? What I suggest, Maria, is call back when we do the garden show, because this comes up a lot with squirrels eating plants and various other things around a garden, and the guys have often tackled this subject.
Oh, good. Okay. I will do that.
Yeah, I would suspect you can make that deterrent yourself. You can take the hot pepper and you can blend that and make a fluid of it to put on there.
Okay.
And that'll be a lot cheaper. I did that last year on my garden. I made the deterrent.
Yeah.
It was inexpensive.
You know, Rich Guthrie.
Really good with deer.
Our bird guy has often talked about squirrels going after bird feeders, and I think he mentioned that the birds have no problem with the pepper. I guess they can't taste it, but the squirrels do. So
yeah, very few birds are able to have any taste.
All right, let's go to Anthony in Woodstock.
Taste buds functioning.
Anthony, you're on.
Hey, I have two answers from earlier callers. One is that bugs have antifreeze, some of them.
Bugs have antifreeze. I see. Okay.
All right. Two, the guy with the bats, he should put bat boxes up on the outside of his house, and maybe they won't go inside it.
Okay, does that make sense to you, Ward? the guy who had bats in his belfry in his attic?
It's probably the kind of bats that like an attic space.
Okay.
And they go and move there. But it's good suggestions that Anthony has made.
All right.
But my original call was about deer and possums. Both animals, I learned that the possum is the Virginia possum. And back in the 1920s, that's about as far north as you'd even find it. So that animal's range has expanded here. And some of the proof is that they get frostbite and they lose parts of their tail, their ears, and their fingers. Hmm. I saved a bunch of babies last year. I pulled them out of a dead mother in the road.
Wow.
But, so I was going to bring up deer. The deer is Odocelus virginianus. It's the Virginia white-tailed deer. That's not even our native deer species, is it?
Yeah,
and
it is.
And how long do you think it's been here for? It is?
It is.
Why do they call it the Virginia white-tailed deer?
Well, we were just talking about the squirrels. We were talking about black squirrels and brown and gray squirrels. Well, they're all the same species.
Well, the black
Scirius carolinensis. And that it's because that's where the original people who did the taxonomy put them in the Latin.
Okay. All right. Well, Anthony, thanks a lot.
And Virginia was a big place where there was a lot of species named.
Okay, here's one
Carolinas
that
too.
Comes in via email, Ward Stone. This one's from Daniel. It says, the coyotes, which are otherwise regularly vocal, go silent in the winter. I assume they're still as nearby as usual, but the nightly howling is absent. Any reason for this?
Well, I think that they're more vocal before they break up with the young ones, the young families. And they break up in the fall, early part of the winter. So then I think it's, you know, quieter for a while.
Okay.
But you can still hear them howling.
All right.
And, of course, this is the coming through the breeding season.
So now it's time for a full howl. All right, let's go to Bill in Orange. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, hello. I just wanted to say I made a rare bird spotting. Or I saw a bird that I thought I knew what it was.
What was
it? I went to the bird book and everything, and I have friends that say I'm crazy, but I know what I saw.
What was it?
It was a hawk owl.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly a possibility.
You think so? Okay. It's possible.
Oh, they've been seen before in New York. As I recall, the last ones were seen not all that far from Cobleseal.
Okay, so this is not out of the realm of possibility.
No, that and the great gray owl as well.
Okay, so what I saw was I was sat in a chair, and there's this tree, this little bunch of trees that aren't more than 30 feet, 35 feet from my house, and there's a barbecue there with a rock wall kind of a thing, and it was that day where we had that tremendous 3-inch rainstorm, and out here in Massachusetts, anyway, in December. And I was sat in a chair, it was daytime, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw this motion, and I looked up, and I went, wow, it's a Cooper's hawk, because it was wheeled from the ground up into the tree, and it was brown and white spots on the wings. And he sat there, and I'm looking at him, I say, that has to be a hawk, because the eyes were yellow, big yellow eyes with black in the middle. But the tail wasn't long enough, and I went and I got the bird book, and I came back, and I didn't know what to do. And then the owl turned its head, and I went, oh, that's a freaking, excuse me.
Yeah, nice.
That was an owl. So then I found this hawk owl, and I looked at it. It's exactly the same that I could see. So it's possible.
Wow.
Well, seeing a small hawk would not be very surprising either. So probably more, although the hawk owl is possible, probably one of the smaller hawk species is more likely.
But when it turned its head at 90 degrees, it had like a diving bell on its head. It was just a classic owl head.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, anyway, that's my story, and I have a disagreement, but I'm sticking to it. I think.
Well, Ward's on your side. Thanks, Bill. We appreciate the call. Number.
It's certainly possible. It's certainly possible. And that's why we do things that we do, all the bird watching, and Did you you looked at a couple of books? You look at Sibley?
Yeah, well, I don't know. He's gone, but we'll follow up with him on the next one. Let's go to Bill in Great Barrington. Bill, you're on.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. Boy, this snowballs. I originally called in to mention to the gentleman who is having reduced population at his feeders. I had noticed my goldfinch population, which mobbed me last few years, was way down this winter early on. And I talked to our dear local bird lady, and she told me that, well, your seed is probably moldy. And I said, no, it looks just fine, pours just fine, no mildew. She said, check your seed. After refreshing it with the old seed, there were still no new goldfinches or many goldfinches. I replaced the seed with fresh seed, and lo and behold, I'm mobbed by finches again.
Simple solution.
Even though you can't sometimes see the mold, it's there, and the birds are rejecting it.
Or something else.
I'm sorry?
Or time has changed, and they would have been there anyway.
Yes.
You can't tell with the data that you have entirely what the cause of the change.
But if they come back after he changes the feed.
We had them all last winter. I mean, last year there were just, they never stopped. Sometimes there were more males than females, but that was about it. This year we noticed a real, like, drop-off in the population coming to the feeders, almost to the point of, you know, you'd sit and watch for half the day and nobody would land on that Niger seed feeder. But my second thing was my dear friend Ellie told me that, yes, it's the young coyotes that do a lot of the howling with the encouragement of their parents, and that's why you hear it so much in that late summer into early fall, and why it goes silent in the winter, because the young aren't finding their voices as much. They are now grown more. And lastly, the last gentleman who called, I moved to the Berkshires from the coast of Connecticut, and we lived on a tidal pond, and I had windows that faced trees that were maybe 4 or 5 feet outside my window, and I also had a large grape arbor off the basement side. And whenever it got foggy or the rain got particularly icky, we would have this large bird come in and hang out in either the trees or in the grapevine arbor. And we noticed it was as big as a hawk, but it had a shorter tail, and its beak looked slightly different. And with our Sibley book, we too determined we had a hawk owl. And I was able to sit and observe him through the window from maybe 4 feet away, while he, you know, eviscerated a pigeon or otherwise had a snack while he was waiting for the weather to lift. And when the fog and the misty weather would drift offshore again, he would fly away. So, yes, I believe it's probably very possible that the other gentleman saw a hawk owl, too.
It's certainly possible.
Always cool.
One thing to take a hard look at coming into grapes is that a rough grouse.
No, this was no rough grouse.
No rough grouse. you know your partridge.
All right, Bill.
This was an urban coast, and we didn't see partridge or rough grouse.
All right.
This was right on the coast of Connecticut. And from the book, I mean, as I said, we sat 3 feet away from it with binoculars and things and ID'd it. It was very definitely the classic Sibley illustration of a hawk owl.
All right, Bill. Well, we're going to move it along, but thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Ward Stone is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Jeff in Montague, New Jersey. Jeff, you're on.
Yeah, hey, thank you. My question is regarding the migratory robin of spring. I volunteer for Project Feeder Watch with Cornell University, like a lot of people do. And I'm watching the different birds. And, of course, the robins come up here, and, you know, they're the beautiful birds of spring. They're red breasts. But about 2 months ago, in the winter, I saw a robin here, or at least I was pretty sure I did. And then about a week ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago, I saw it again in the same neighborhood, about a block from where I live. Is it possible this one didn't migrate, or do they always migrate? That's my question.
There always have been flocks of robins in the winter. They do hang around, and they eat various wild fruit. And I've seen flocks as big as 200 in the wintertime.
I have one more question real quick.
Sure.
Dark-eyed juncos are normally migratory birds, but this summer I didn't see very many of them. And I'm wondering, do they ever migrate? I see them all every winter, lots of them. But do they migrate north in the winter?
Yes, they do.
That's what I was thinking. Okay, great. So I do have a robin in my neighborhood in the winter, and I was correct about them going north.
They
great,
can go north as well as south.
Jeff, yeah. Thanks a lot for the call. A lot of bird calls today.
Yep.
It's very, very strange how things go.
Wardstone, as cold as it's been, a lot of people have been, you know, watching birds at their feeders.
Yep, that's true. Wardstone
is
our
good
guest.
Thing to do.
Let's go to Anton in Ackerd. Anton, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
A couple months back, we had a deer come through over the period of a couple weeks, and its tongue was hanging way out of its mouth, like 8 inches out of its mouth. We got a pretty good look at it a couple times. A quick Google search made it look like maybe it was black tongue or blue tongue, which I guess is a wasting disease. Is that sound right?
Viral disease, blue tongue?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, was it a small deer?
It was probably a yearling. Maybe it was two. Yeah, it was a small doe.
The reason why I mentioned it is that when I was a pathologist, I got a call on a sick doe deer. And that had her tongue out. So I called and called, and tongue stayed out. So we had the deer destroyed because we thought it was sick.
Right.
Had something like blue tongue or something like that.
Yeah.
It turned out that it didn't have any of those things. It was a 23-year-old female deer. And she was pregnant.
Yikes.
At 23. Or thereabouts. It's hard to tell precisely. The older the animal is, the less exact you are with your age determination.
So that made the tongue stick out?
Well, what happened was the deer have no top teeth in the front.
Okay.
Here. They have these here. And the tongue, they'll get worn right down to the gum.
Right.
So the tongue comes out. But I felt really bad because the fetus looked really good.
Yeah.
And what I was looking at was, that was the matriarch of the group of deer. You know, and there were daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters and so on present there in that group. And she was at that point where she didn't have any teeth left.
Oh, boy.
She had ground them all down.
Yikes.
At 23.
Well, it was a good run.
So that's why I've asked him again, because that was the oldest white-tailed deer at that point that had ever been found in the wild.
Tell you what, let's take a quick break here. Wardstone is our guest, and we'll be back with more of your calls on Vox Pop at 1-800-348-2551 in a moment.
Support comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community. Berkshire.coop. And Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities. Open 7 days a week. YeOldWarwickBookshop.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Ward Stone is our guest, and you got family listening today, huh?
Yeah, another Syracuse University person.
All right. Listening
Jeremiah Stone.
All right, Jeremiah, well, a shout-out to you, and here are a couple from email, Ward. This one says, big brown bats are somewhat active during the winter months, looking for water. Within the past month, I delivered two of them to a New York State licensed rehabilitator. She informed me that they don't live in groups and aren't likely to suffer from white nose syndrome. There you go. Here's another one. This is from, oh, that was
okay.
From,
first
that was
of all,
Bob.
They tend to be like in the attics of buildings.
Yeah.
So it may be environmentally that it's not a good place for the fungus.
Mm, okay, that's a good point. So living inside.
So I really know that, you know, a lot of stuff was going on with that fungus. Mm. But I noticed long ago that that was the case. And I was kind of happy about it because you weren't going to get that white nose syndrome going very heavily.
So in caves, there's more fungus.
Caves more likely.
Yeah.
Coal mines.
Yeah. All right, here's one from Nancy from LaGrange. Could you please describe the variety of milkweed I can plant in my backyard to encourage monarch activity? I heard that if we plant the wrong type, it can interfere with the timing of the caterpillar feeding and end up making them vulnerable to certain parasites. And that's from Nancy in LaGrange.
There's one main type. And so if you can get the seeds from the ones around where you live,
mm-hmm.
and plant those, you're all set.
Okay, but so you have not heard one variety of milkweed that is detrimental to the caterpillars?
What I'm saying is you can take the milkweed pods. They have so many seeds.
Yeah.
And take them that are in your area and plant those.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. And Jeff at Union College. Jeff, you're on.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on Ward's earlier comment about deer populations and worried about this harsh winter, but I just want to draw attention to your listeners of our overall overpopulation of deer. So a well-managed deer population that's lower than it is today is healthier for forests, and it's also healthier for deer so that they don't suffer spasms of starvation in harsh winters like this.
But open to a lot of debate over what is the right amount. If you're interested in forest, you're interested in wildflowers, trilliums, and so on, then there's too many deer. And, you know, we could get by with a lot lower population and have a healthier environment. And like I mentioned earlier, if you're a deer hunter who's interested in a good high deer population and taking a deer to eat every year, then they can stand to have more deer. So,
and
it
so
depends
I think it's
upon
up to the state
whose
in
ox
order
is
to,
being gored.
So I think that it's up to the state habitat managers to look to the broader interest of its citizens to think that a healthy forest serves far more people and ultimately is favorable to the deer and the hunters that we don't have a forest that can't replace itself. Nature Conservancy scientists have determined that as much as a third of the forest in the state does not have a healthy enough understory to be able to replace itself. So in the long run, that's bad for the deer and bad for hunters, too.
What do you think, Ward?
I think there's a great merit to what he says about being able to replace the forest and take care of the forest that's out there and that we're not managing for that because it would be a lower deer population. But I think there's great merit to what he says.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Marion in Fultonville. Marion, you're on with Ward Stone.
Oh, good afternoon, and thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, with all the bitter cold that we've had, and especially the wind, how do the birds survive? No leaves on the trees? I put bird food out, and I do have mourning doves and cardinals and sparrows, and then a gazillion crows come in and take over. But what do they do at night, and especially with all the wind, the terrible wind that we've been having?
They go into holes in trees, cracks and crevices in trees. That'll give them some protection. They'll go into birdhouses. I've seen bluebirds go into bluebird houses, spend the night, and send six, eight, ten birds
in the country
at a time.
And no bird houses or anything like that around. I don't.
Well, they'll find places to go. They will find places to go where there's slits in the trees where they can get under the bark and holes in the trees where there's been insect damage. They'll get into those areas, and away they'll go.
Okay.
Okay.
It is. There's a whole series of things that they do.
When you were talking at night, the
person before who was talking about the rabbits coming.
Getting out of the wind.
I do have rabbits come out at night, and also my neighbor saw a whole pack of coyotes, and I guess they are coming out after the rabbits.
Oh, boy.
And I didn't hear them, but my neighbors saw them, and they were howling, and I guess they are out after the rabbits that come out for the bird food at night.
Yikes. Isn't nature wonderful? Marion, thanks a lot for the call.
Well, the coyotes okay. will eat that bird feed, too.
Okay. Oh, will they really?
There's no doubt about
Omnivores
that.
Omnivores they are?
They're an amazing animal.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't see too many in my neighborhood.
You know, I did so many postmortems, you know, related to them.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at one a long time ago, and it had probably 2.5-3 pounds of grasshoppers in the stomach.
What?
The only thing it ate was grasshoppers.
Wow.
It was in a field with lots and lots of grasshoppers. And
good protein,
good
right?
Good protein.
Yeah. Put a little chocolate on.
Making the most of that.
All right, let's go over to Pat in North Greenbush. Pat, you're good. You're on. Hello, Pat, you're on.
Yes, I'm from North Greenbush.
Hello.
And on a very cold day in February, I looked out my window, and I thought I saw a woodpecker, and he was black and white. Is that possible, Ward?
Yes, that's probable.
Really?
Black and white, red. Those are the colors that we have in our woodpeckers.
I didn't see any red.
The amount of red has to do whether male or female.
The way they used to dress. And,
I'll tell you, I'm seeing a woodpecker out there, not too far. You're in North Greenbush,
yeah.
And I'm in Troy.
Yeah.
The red-bellied woodpecker.
For heaven's sake.
Which is...
It was a terribly cold
been
day.
Around for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But more to the south. And
yeah.
they're coming on pretty well in this area. It's a beautiful woodpecker.
Oh, I should say. I my only wish that... There were more. I love to look at them, but I was worried about him surviving, but it's okay, huh?
He'll make it through the winter?
Oh,
I think so.
Okay. And you know what?
Good.
Winter's almost done, Pat. Let's just think spring now, right?
Okay, it's a deal, and thank you very much for your courtesy.
We appreciate the call. Let's go over to...
Pat, the fatty foods are good for them right now, too.
Fair enough. Lauren in Albany.
Anything that's eating insects will probably go for the suet.
Okay. Lauren, suet. You're on.
Hi, I just have a quick question for you. I was working a job in New York as a wildlife technician this summer, and we were doing a necropsy on a few fawns where we found that there was a lining that, like a membrane that formed that was abnormal between the like heart and lungs and adhering to the rib cage, and a lot of us were really stumped as to what might cause that, and it caused like a discoloration in the heart as if the fawn had a heart attack and died. And I wasn't sure if you had any idea as to what that disease might be that would cause a symptom like that.
What do you think, Ward?
Did they have a pericarditis of some kind?
Yes.
It sounds like a pericarditis. I don't know, but I'd like to look at some of the blood and some of the tissues from it.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds good.
That, I spent my life looking at things like that.
Did you ever see anything like that in
yes.
your time?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot
That's
for
that. That's why I changed it over to a little bit different terms.
Well, I know. The one that no one else but you two understood. So we'll just move on from there. Here's an email from Jeff who says, there are two types of milkweed. One is bad because it blooms for months longer than native milkweed, so the monarchs will stay too long before they migrate, and it kills a lot of them when local stores sell the wrong seeds. Aha! Isn't that interesting?
There are a lot of different milkweeds.
Okay.
Most all of them will help. The big problem is not so much the milkweed. It's the poisons that are with the milkweed now because they've developed a atrazine that they can treat corn plants with.
Uh-huh.
And the weeds, like the, will not grow. But it also may be poisoning the butterflies.
Okay, let's go to Julie in Highland, New York. Julie, hello.
Hi. I do not have a bird question.
Okay, fair enough.
I have a question about, under my porch, there is a big hole, and a woodchuck was living there. He's moved out or got killed by a fox or something. And I have a skunk living in the hole now. And the other morning I was leaving for work at 5:30, in the morning, and the smell hit me like a ton of bricks. First of all, I understand they don't hibernate. They just kind of stay low, like we all are right now. How am I going to get rid of it once spring comes? Because I know the season of mating is upon us soon for him. No.
Ah, the romantic time for the skunks. Lepew. All right, so what do you think, Ward?
He already got my dog once.
Oh, that's terrible. So what do you use, tomato juice on that?
It was at 3 in the morning, and I woke up to the smell, and my husband and I burst out of bed, and my kids had him in the bathtub full of tomato sauce. It was hysterical.
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's awful. All right, Ward, what do you think?
It's a difficult question. It's a difficult to, in a practical sense, because the skunk is down there now.
Yeah.
The breeding season is upon us. So there's likely to be baby skunks there.
Right now,
so
you think,
about
yeah.
May, you're likely to see mama out there with a walk, taking a walk with a string of little baby skunks.
It's
right
very
behind
cute.
Her.
I saw that last fall, I think.
They're
I saw
really
some...
cute.
Oh, yeah, until the smell. And aside
sadly,
from that,
I've seen that on the road, which is not so cute.
Yeah, so I mean, is there any way, aside from killing them, to get rid of them, Ward? That's the crux of the issue here.
Yeah, I don't want to kill anybody.
Okay.
Live and let live.
Well, what do you think? Ward's thinking.
I think there's some things that they may not like too well.
Okay.
Well, my cat is under there doing his part all the time because it's the only dirt around right mm-hmm. now.
Oh, boy.
I understand.
So Skunk is not probably appreciative of that.
No.
That may be helpful.
Yeah.
So you have no you can't get rid of the skunks, basically. Is that what I'm trying to get from Ward here? You can't get rid of the skunks?
I'm thinking of what you would apply.
Okay. All right, well, we have 6 minutes left.
And I can't think of anything that you would apply which would be consistent in getting rid of the skunk.
Okay, well, you know, Julie, we'll come back. We'll do the show. And if you found a great way, please let us know, all right?
All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot. Okay, Greg in Gallatin. Greg, you're on.
Hi. First, I'd like to thank Ward for the wonderful work he's done through his life for the ecosystem. I have a question. A neighbor had a couple of box turtles, and they were moving away, and I took them, and I keep them in my garden, which has a deep fence, and they, you know, they seem quite happy in the garden, and they hibernate in the garden, and I pile leaves on top of them and everything. But at some point, you know, I may want to not have box turtles, and I'm wondering, is it okay to release them in the wild, and where would you release them, and things like that?
Well, they have been released in the wild. I've seen them released by DEC personnel within the pine bush.
Okay.
Box turtles.
Hmm.
But they may not be the same box turtle that's being released there because they may be from a different population, which doesn't do that well there. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, well, these are northeastern box turtles, for what that's worth.
Hmm.
So you're kind of getting around that question at the moment by putting in your fence and lots of protective material for them to winter in.
They're in the garden. You know, I got a thing of water I change every day, and you know they eat slugs and stuff, and I also feed them vegetable matter and cat food and all. And in the winter they dig down, and as they dig down, I pick up the bags of leaves that are on the side of the road, and I pile them on and. I've done this for a couple of winters. They seem to be, you know, healthy. But I just didn't know, you know, apparently they may live a lot longer than me. I guess they can live like 100 years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know if I could talk my granddaughter into becoming a box turtle farmer or... I'd heard one thing more that box turtles have a tendency to want to go back to where they were born or something.
Back to the box?
I don't know.
What do you think, Ward? True? Not true. Myth? Not myth.
I don't think they think like that.
They don't think like that?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
No.
Greg,
all
right. Great
call. I think
that's
innate, that those central nervous system circuits are taken up by evolutionary processes.
Okay. Let's get one more call in here before we wrap it up, at least one more. This is Kate in Pittsfield. Hiya, Kate. You're on with Ward Stone.
Hi.
So good to have you back, Mr. Stone. My question is about rabbits. My dog, my terrier, killed a rabbit. I had to put it in the trash, which I felt terrible about. When I lived in Connecticut, we had a person who was rehabilitating injured animals, wild animals, and she would take animals like the rabbit and use them as food for the animals that she was rehabilitating, something that they would eat normally out in the wild.
Yeah.
Is there anybody around here like that who I can call the next time my little Dickens gets hold of a rabbit?
Yeah. Okay. Is there...
There are a lot of people who are still rehabbing the rabbits. I would call...
No, the dead rabbit. What do you do with the dead rabbit? In other words, right. Is there a recycler, a recycle program? Can you put it in the recycle bin is the question.
Mm.
So using the used for dead animals coming up on Vox Pop.
We could try that.
Okay. So
I would get a hold of some rehabbers by, which is what I was going to suggest.
Okay.
Calling the DC office.
Good idea.
And getting the name of a couple of rehabbers who might need some rabbit tissue for, like, rehabbing foxes.
Well, that's a great idea.
Red foxes, gray foxes.
Kate, I'm sorry to say we're out of time here. I do appreciate the call.
DEC office?
DEC office, right?
DEC, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Kate. We appreciate it.
Or you're in Massachusetts, though. Your Department of Natural Resources.
Okay.
And they should be able to do the same kind of thing.
Well, that was terrific and a great way to end the show. Ward Stone, a beautiful job, my friend. Support comes from the Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care, CECAA.com, and the ADK Cafe, a delicious kitchen in Keene, New York, serving home-cooked breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day, the ADKCafe.com. Thanks again to the great Ward Stone. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, who was at the controls. Thanks to Mary Vetter, who answered the phones. Thanks to you for calling and for listening. Thanks to our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall, who set this whole thing up. Thank you, Jessica. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a Food Friday. Have a great rest of the day. The news is next.